Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Journey to Success Radio Network. Our purpose on Journey to Success Radio is to interview and promote people who are making a positive difference in this world. My name's Tom Tutall Cunningham. I'm a motivational speaker helping people to live positively with and through the many and varied challenges that life brings us. I've had rheumatoid arthritis from my jaw to my toes since the age of 5. That's 45 years now, and in that time I've had 4 hips, 4 knees, and 2 shoulders replaced and been hospitalized about 40 times. I also stand about 5'1", hence the nickname Too Tall, and that's due to the heavy daily doses of the steroid prednisone that I had to take to fight my arthritis. And of course, anyone who knows me knows that despite those challenges, I always answer amazing when asked how I'm doing. You can find out more about me at my website at tom2 and tall.com. My guest host today is Brad Zalozzi. Brad, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hey, Tom, how you doing? And welcome to everybody who's listening out there. My name is Brad Zalas, and I am the author of Liquid Leadership from Woodstock to Wikipedia. And what I specialize in, and I think, Tom, you enjoyed some of the work that I do when we were out in California, and what I specialize in is I help you bridge the generational chaos that's happening not only internally in companies all around the world, but in your sales, marketing, parenting, and even education.
Love it. And our guest today is Greg Link. Greg is the co-founder of Covey Link, the Franklin Covey Speed of Trust Practice, and the former Covey Leadership Center. He is co-author with Stephen M. R. Covey of the Wall Street Journal and number one Amazon bestseller, Smart Trust, Creating Prosperity, Energy, and Joy in a Low-Trust World. Greg is a trusted and sought-after executive confidant, advisor, and compelling speaker. He is a recognized authority on the impact of trust on business, growth, leadership, sales, marketing, and high performance. He orchestrated the strategy that led Dr. Stephen Covey's book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, to one of the 2 most influential books of the 20th century, according to CEO Magazine. So welcome to this show today, Greg. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Tom, I'm so happy to be with you. Your reputation precedes you. You're an inspiration to all of us.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to have you on the show. Greg, when I think about sales, which is kind of most close to my heart in my career, Zig Ziglar always said that people will buy from you if they like you and they trust you.
So, yet
at the same time, I've never read a book on trust before. I cannot recall ever reading a book with the word trust in it. So what would make you decide to write a book about the topic of trust?
Well, it's interesting because, as you mentioned, the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People was one of the best-selling business books in history, and that gave us an opportunity not only to do business in over 100 countries around the world, but to meet with and talk to and work with entrepreneurs and executives and highly successful people all over the world. And one of the things we started to realize is the common thread, they didn't necessarily use trust either, Tom, in all cases. But as you talk to them, we started to find 13 behaviors that were common to high trust leaders. And we then discovered that, you know, the premise that we trust people based upon their observable behaviors, what they do. We watch what they do, not what they say. We judge ourselves by our good intentions. We judge others by their observable behaviors. And once we got onto that track and started to ask people, just like you, Tom, they say, well, gosh, I never thought of it that way. But almost 100% of them, when asked, would attribute their success and sometimes their failure to the ability to grow trust or, in the bad cases, to lose trust with their customers or other significant stakeholders. So it's a thread that's common to all success, and you're right, not much has been published on it, but we're finding that the thing that makes it so powerful is it's so common sense. People can validate it from their own experience. And so it really does, putting on that trust lens and being able to see things through that lens really has been a useful way for leaders and managers around the world to improve themselves and to have more influence.
I love it. I love it. And my guest host today, Brad Solozzi, with his book, Liquid Leadership and Focusing on Intergenerational Communication. I'm a 50-year-old, and I come to now know that this younger generation, trust of older people is not the same as when I was young. You trusted anybody in authority.
Not at all.
And so no, I didn't call anybody I didn't call anybody by their first name until I was past 30 years old. And so, Brad, do you have any comment or question for Greg on trust and how it relates to intergenerational? Because it's not assumed trust anymore. You got to earn it.
Oh, not at all. Greg, I just want to tell you, this is a fascinating topic. And I'm a former C-level executive, and I got to tell you, if you don't show people that you are embodying trust, that they can trust you and all that, they're not going to stay on board anymore, and especially with the next generation.
Yeah, boy, trust is a prerequisite. You know, having the autonomy and being trusted by management, working for organizations that extend trust and give you the latitude is critical to this upcoming generation, I guess I'll call them.
Yes. Well, they're about ready for leadership positions, and I think it's important that they hear from mentors like yourself, and I know that trust has been the key on your journey to success. Do you want to talk a little bit about the story that you had in your book about the very first time someone extended trust to you?
Sure. Yeah, it was a milestone event for me. I grew up and was, I wasn't there were no weapons involved, but I was a juvenile delinquent. You know, we'll just say it like it is. I mean, I was a bad kid, and I managed to squeak my way out of high school and get into college. And the first job that I got, I worked my way through college, and the first job that I got, I'd been there about 3 months. The only job I'd ever had, really, other than digging a sprinkling system pipe, was working in a grocery store. And one day, a few months after I'd been working there, the boss, the manager, came up to me and handed me the keys to the store and the combination to the safe. And he said, "I got to go in 4 hours. I need you to lock up and put all the money in the safe." Man, if he had any idea who he was trusting, he would have never given me that the responsibility. But he was the first adult that ever trusted me, and it changed my life. I didn't not want to let the man down. So the point of the story is that, people think trusting is risky, and you could argue that that was risky on his part, but most of the time people reciprocate trust, and it's kind of ironic that if you want to grow trust with people, you've got to extend trust to them. You've got to give trust first, and it is reciprocal, and we all can validate that in our own experience, how we interact with different people. One of the interesting things, we do an exercise where we ask people to think of a person that they have a high trust relationship with, and we won't take the time to do that now, but what people think of, they come up with all these great things about what it's like to be with this high trust person. It's fast, it's safe, it's energizing, all these great descriptors. And then I ask them, what's the one thing you didn't think of when you were thinking of that person that you had a high trust relationship with? And it's a rhetorical question, but they didn't think of the generation, the age of the person. They didn't think of the gender of the person. They didn't think of the ethnicity of the person. We trust people because they have character and competence. We trust people who do what they say they're going to do. And we develop these relationships, and trust can transcend all of the other things that take us apart, whether it's generation or gender. And it really is a key insight for people to learn that if you can behave in ways that engender trust, it gets all the other restraining forces out of the way.
Wow. That's phenomenal.
Oh, love it. And yet at the same time, Greg, you write about the great paradox of trust. Tell us about that great paradox.
Well, yeah, the paradox is, it's counterintuitive that at the time in history when we have the lowest trust, and we've got all these scandals that are going on and bankruptcies and the financial crisis and all the fraud that's gone on. At the same time, we've got the lowest level of trust in history. We're seeing and experiencing a renaissance of trust where more companies are realizing, hey, the only way we're going to get this to work, the only way the economy is going to work is we've got to develop and build trust. In the financial crisis, the banks, the government made money available. They made them liquid. There was money to lend, But for a long time, the banks didn't trust each other, and they wouldn't lend the money. So the financial crisis took way longer than it did because, you know, credit is another word for trust. And it really does make a big difference. So it's an important factor. And it is paradoxical that at the same time we have low trust, we also are experiencing extraordinary examples of high trust companies, high trust organizations around the world.
Wow.
Very true. Brad, anything anything to add or any other question there?
Sure.
Greg,
well, there's a great quote that I saw on LinkedIn and the Internet. It's floating around. Everybody's seen it. But basically, a CFO, the financial officer of a company, goes to a CEO, and he says, why should I pay for more training? Why should I pay for people to get trained, and then they just leave anyways? And the CEO responds, he goes, well, what if we don't train them and they stay?
And that is really good, Brad.
I like that one. And I'm saying, I want to ask you, because this generation coming up, they saw their parents lose their pensions. They've seen their parents work their tail off. The financial crisis hit them. Their baby boomer parents dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. And I have to ask you, how do we regain and establish trust?
Well, the beauty of it is I think that the circumstances we find ourselves in are going to drive it, just like the paradox of the high trust and the low trust world. The way to grow trust in a low trust world is to be trustworthy, to be credible, develop your own reputation, control your own destiny. And the title of our book being Smart Trust, we're talking about smart trust. Russians have a saying, pravorye devorye, which is trust but verify. And I probably butchered the pronunciation of that, I always do. But at any rate, it's trust but verify. And so the younger generation is a little skeptical of these organizations. And so they do want to trust, but they also want to verify. They want to do their due diligence. And what's going to happen, the unique competitive advantage in the economy is particularly driven by social media and the transparency of information, is the talent is going to gravitate to the companies, as we talked about before, who trust them and extend trust to them and give them the opportunity and the autonomy and follow through on what they say. And so the competitors that really do operate in a high-trust way are going to attract all the talent. And that's what sets Google and Microsoft, a lot of them, apart, is they've gone after the best talent, the best and brightest, and they've trusted them. Google gives their employees a 20% time to work on whatever project they want to work on the clock. And Zappos lets managers on the clock take their people out to get to know each other and go bowling if they want, whatever. But again, it's a function of trust. It's extending and saying, you're important, you're on the team, we're all in this together. It makes a big difference, and those people are going to stay. And that is the unique competitive advantage as it relates to trust, particularly, Brad, with these younger people that have seen their parents get burned.
I think it's amazing to watch because for us baby boomers, we were taught that we had to earn our way in a corporation. And this is very linear, and it takes a long time.
Right.
You get to this next level, and then you might, when you're 50 years old, have the right to talk to the CEO. And today you get young people who have been trained in more of a collaborative way of working. By the way, 60% of college graduates want to work at Google. Just want to throw that out there. And who wouldn't? You know, you're in these great environments.
Exactly.
But here's the thing. It's a peer-to-peer network. They believe they have the right to just walk up to the CEO and chat with them. And the other thing I found fascinating is this. They get peer reviews, and a lot of them are getting promoted every couple of months, every 3 months, every 6 months, very quickly, because they've gained the trust of their team. Do you want to talk a little bit about
that? And they were competent. They performed. They did what they said they were going to do. They have a track record.
Yeah.
That's really a good insight, Brad.
Yeah, I find this fascinating. I mean, Tom and I, when Tom called me up and said, hey, would you like to be in on this? I was like, this, finally, here is a subject no one talks about, but it's very important.
Exactly. Greg, what's so important, we can talk about this and write about this, but let leaders, current leaders and future leaders, give us five actions, things that we can do to become a high trust leader? Rather than talking about it and preaching about it, how can we demonstrate it as leaders ourselves?
It's a great question, and that's basically what we wrote the book about. I want to premise it with a current event here, preface it with a current event, and say a little about American Airlines. I don't know if you followed the U.S. Air American Airlines merger, but last spring I was at Thunderbird International Business School, which is the number one rated business school in the world there in Arizona. And the CEO of U.S. Airways, Tom Brady, the CEO spoke. He was the keynote. He was the commencement speaker. And he said, I'm going to tell you the secret to business that they didn't teach you at Thunderbird. And he said, Thunderbird's a great business school, but they don't teach it in any of the business schools. And he says, that point is relationships, high trust relationships matter. And he said that American Airlines, and by the way, for those that aren't familiar, the combination of these two airlines is forming the largest airline in the world at $11 billion-plus dollars. So this is a big deal. And American was in bankruptcy. They did not want to merge. And he had the version, it's Parker is his name, that had the vision, the CEO of the other airline, in Phoenix there, U.S. Air, had the vision to merge, but American didn't want to do it. And so they had a series of meetings, and he said the entire merger turned on a number of incidents where American Airlines people, particularly in the union, ran across people on the U.S. Air team that they'd known from a previous job or project or whatever, and they had a high trust relationship with. And that was the kernel that turned the entire merger into a possibility and now is going to be a fait accompli. And so it's these five actions that inform a lot of these stories that we read about. And the first one is to believe and trust, to have a fundamental belief and trust. And that's what he exhibited by having a propensity to consider that and choose to believe and trust that he could, even in spite of all the feedback from American Airline executives, he felt that there was a way that they could make this work. And having a belief that people are fundamentally trustworthy and worthy of trust, and that most people can be trusted, and that, more importantly, a belief that extending trust is a better way to lead an organization. That's a key thing. You've got to have that fundamental belief to be willing to take the risk. And then the second smart trust action is to start with yourself. And it flows out of the first. But the minute you think the problem's out there, that very thought's the problem. We have a tendency to blame the circumstances, the economy, our coworkers, the customers, whoever we want to blame. But if you take responsibility and look to your own integrity, your own character and competence, and there's the two sides to trust as we define it, that you have both the character, which is the price of entry in this day and age, to have integrity and have good intentions, and then also you've got to balance that, as we've talked about, Brad, with the competence. You've got to do what you say you're going to do, and you've got to pull through. And so having that self-confidence really is an important step forward for these smart trust leaders. And then the smart trust action number three is to declare your intent. Now, this is one that we've really kind of stumbled upon. We've been talking about transparency and trust and all that for a long time, but what we discovered is that if you want to persuade somebody or influence somebody, the tendency is to go into your pitch, your presentation, and what's the other party doing? They're kind of back on their heels. Going, you know, where's she going with this? Where's he going with this? When's the other shoe going to drop? We're not even listening. So to take their sword out of their hand, it's counterintuitive, but lay your cards on the table. Assume trust. Declare your intent. Say, here's what I'd like to accomplish. Here's what I'd like to hope to accomplish in this meeting. And this is how they did it in the American Airlines merger. Here's what we're trying to accomplish. Here's what we hope. And then that, they may not agree with you, but at least they know where you stand, and they're then able to listen to your argument and then give their counterargument, and it makes a whole different experience. The second part of that is assuming positive intent in others. When I drive a car, if somebody pulls out in front of me, I have the feeling they looked me right in the eyes and pulled out in front of me deliberately. my sweet wife reminds me that maybe they didn't have that intention. Maybe they didn't see me, or maybe they have a sick child in the car. So assuming positive intent, and Indra Nooyi, who's the CEO of PepsiCo, said that that's the one thing she learned from her father, was that you want to assume positive intent in others. Give people the benefit of the doubt, and then trust becomes a performance multiplier. And then fourth, in this fourth smart trust action, is to do what you say you're going to do. And this is really significant in this day and age of a global economy and, you know, talking across generations and in some of the other contexts that we operate in. We were speaking with the CEO in London, England, and he did business in over 180 countries around the world, which is the majority of companies or countries that even have an economy, as you know. And at any rate, we asked him if trust was prevalent in all the different places he operated. And he said, yeah, everybody has a high value for trust. They all practice it a little bit differently. But the one thing that he identified that validated our assumption that everybody has in common is you trust people who do what they say they're going to do. And the fastest way to build trust is to make a promise and keep it. And that's the fastest way to break trust, is to make a promise and not keep it. So, again, behaviors. You behave your way into it. So doing what you say you're going to do, having that reputation, that track record, that personal brand. And then finally, and this is the most leveraged one for organizations and for aspiring people in their careers, that ultimately the art of the deal in business is to gain influence and to expand your organization and your influence by leading out and extending trust, giving people responsibility, taking the risk. We have managers tell us all the time, well, gosh, I just don't want to lose control. And they think they're managing, they think they're leading, but meanwhile, they're really managing and micromanaging and hovering over people. They're not giving them the benefit of the doubt, and they're not giving them the rope. And again, back to trust but verify, you want to be smart about it. You don't want to set one of your young executives up to lose. You want to give her the benefit of the doubt and give her the chance, but you want to be smart about it. And that's how you develop people. But the propensity, you know, you've got the two extremes. You can be naive and gullible and be too trusting, or you can be too suspicious. And the sweet spot is what we call smart trust, where you have the judgment, where you balance the two. And learning that skill, that one skill, is the defining skill that separates managers from leaders. It gives them the leverage. And it is really a big idea. It produces results. Extending trust increases your capabilities of your people. And lastly, it creates trust by generating reciprocity, as we've talked about before. And the bottom line is leaders go first. We have to be the ones that exemplify these behaviors of high-trust people if we expect people to follow us. So those are the five actions. We've tried to boil it down, and there's a lot of depth in and around all of them, but fundamentally that's the construct that we discovered. And again, we didn't make it up. This came from our interviews with hundreds of executives and leaders and business people of all generations around the world. Speaking of the younger generation, Brad, I'm sure you're familiar with Tony Hsieh,
yes,
the CEO of Zappos. You know, we asked him, you know, he's an online business, and he's trusting his customers to have free shipping, exchange shoes back and forth, you know. And we asked him, how can you, you know, what do you attribute this success? And he grew Zappos into a billion-dollar company online in the worst economic decade in history. And he said he attributed it to two things, trusting his customers and trusting his people, his employees. Well,
he said something that just to me is profound, and I think anybody listening today has to really capture this. This is the seed kernel of truth right now, and that is, and Tony Hsieh, this, I'm quoting him, he said, your corporate culture is your brand.
Boy, isn't that the truth?
Yes.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating what you said, extending the trust. And, you know, I think management from the 20th century was all about babysitting and obedience. And
well,
now
command and control from the military.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think today, though, leadership is about being a shepherd. And I see that at Pixar with John Lasseter when they find somebody that shows that they have the propensity and the ability to lead, they eventually give them the producer's chair or the director's chair for a feature film. Now, that doesn't mean they just throw them out there. they have a huge amount of mentorship, training, and everything that goes with it. And I think you touched on that very much so in your five steps. It's phenomenal. It's really about integrity. That's what I wanted to throw out there.
Well, yeah, and that's certainly the starting point, and that's the price of entry. But in addition, and that's what has been the common definition of trust over the years, is being honest, so to speak. And that's important, and that's the walking your talk. But again, it's the walking the talk part. It's the other part of it. It's doing what you say you're going to do. It's having not only the character but the competence in performing. And that, at the end of the day, we trust people that have both. And Lasseter, by the way, Brad, he's a poster child for what we're talking about.
Yes.
That example you just gave is ideal.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. That's powerful. Tom, you got something cool. I can
Greg,
hear it.
I can recognize Tom's
chuckle.
You have a pretty neat giveaway, Greg, on your website to help our listeners understand restoring trust. So tell us about that, because that's probably pretty neat.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of content in the book, Smart Trust and in Speed of Trust. But one of the things we've found that has been particularly useful to people is shattering the myth that once you've broken trust, that's it. You've lost it forever. And in business, with customers and employees, we're all going to make mistakes. And the ability to restore trust is a lost art. Most of us, or many of us, just give up and just assume, hey, all is lost, she'll never trust me again, or doggone it, I'm never going to buy from them again, I'm never going to trust them. You know, and so we kind of draw a line in the sand. And so the art of the deal is being able to restore trust. And we believe that trust can be restored. There was a Harvard Business Review article by a very reputable academic who said that once trust is lost, all is lost. You know, you can't regain it. And we would say that the opposite is true, that we do acknowledge there are cases that are so egregious that you're never going to trust someone again. Bernie Madoff, in the United States, the investment guy that defrauded everybody would have a heck of a time regaining trust. But for the most part, most of the small mistakes and even big mistakes that we make, we can restore the trust. And it is something that people don't think of, but it is something that's important. And this restoretrustkit.com, you can get a couple video clips and the copy of the 13 behaviors and a number of different tools that can teach you how to restore trust when you were at fault, when you lost the trust, and then also how to regain trust with somebody that violated trust with you. How can you forgive them and be smart about it? Again, we're not talking about getting taken advantage here. We're talking about legitimately restoring the trust, sometimes to a level that's even higher than it was before. There's a great story in the book that Stephen tells in the Speed of Trust book about his son losing his driver's license to his parents for violating their trust. They now trust him more. And it's a great story. I'll leave it at that and let everybody read it. I believe on the restoretrust.com there's an audio clip of him telling that story. So you can go to restoretrustkit.com and get that.
That could also be a handy tool for spouses, any relationship, not just business and parents.
Well, spouses and
anybody.
Teenagers, Tom, are kind of where the rubber meets the road, aren't they?
Yes,
you can pass through those relationships.
Wow.
Exactly. Brad, do you have anything for Greg there?
You know, you can always get your trust back. I think that's fascinating because I was pointing out to people, you know, Michael Milken, the penny stock billionaire, after he got out of jail, he now teaches at Harvard. So I think you can always turn it around, as they say.
Yes.
Yeah, it is possible. And again, it's not just to say you're sorry. You've got to try to make restitution where you can. You've got to be very sincere about it, and you've got to take actions over time sometimes to do it, but it is possible.
Yes,
exactly.
I agree.
My wife is a law clerk for a criminal attorney, so a lot of times people have to go through this kind of a process to restore trust from the government in them and in all the parties involved. And so you can restore trust. It is a process, but you certainly can. Go ahead there, Brad.
Yeah, sometimes it's tough. I think the mayor of Toronto may have a hard time, restoring trust. And again, I don't mean to pick on him on a personal level. You know, that's up to him. But when you're the CEO of an organization like Toronto, you pretty much got to play it a little bit differently. And we just get sound bites down here, so I don't know if I'm missing the boat, but I haven't seen any gestures on his part to try to restore trust with his constituents.
Not at all.
Yes, we're watching here in the States with fascination.
Yes, we are. It's on the late night talk show circuit, Tom.
We understand. We've had a few of our mayors do some crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, in New York, yeah, where you
so
are.
We understand.
San Diego, I think our San Diego mayor was probably worse. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Brad, you had noticed something about the subtitle of Greg's book.
Yes, I wanted to ask you, Greg, you changed the subtitle of the book. Tell us what you felt so passionately about that you and Stephen M. R. Covey felt that you needed to change the subtitle on your book.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it doesn't happen very often, but a lot of people don't realize it, but we changed the subtitle on the Seven Habits book. The original subtitle of The Seven Habits in 1989 was Restoring the Character Ethic, based upon Covey's study of all the success literature for the bicentennial, for the first 200 years of America, and the first 150 years were based on character, and then the next 50 years were based on personality, and he was trying to draw that distinction. Well, what we've discovered since we published the Smart Trust book, certainly the energy and joy and prosperity all still make sense. They're still in it. We didn't take anything out. But we did highlight the fact that, the defining skill, the thing that really separates managers and leaders is the skill of extending smart trust. And so that's why we changed the subtitle, because we found that companies and people all over the place, that associations and companies were overmanaged and underled. And
that's powerful. I like what you just said. Overmanaged and underled.
Nice. So those are some components also that would separate a manager from a leader. Some of the things that you write about in your book, as lots of managers are not leaders. They have leaders underneath them. So what are some of those key components that separate someone who is a manager from someone who actually is a leader on a team? Uh-oh.
Did we lose him? We may have lost him.
We lost him. We'll wait and see if he calls back in. You there, Holly? There he is.
Brad's here.
That was my bad. I'm glad you had Brad there with you, Tom. I think we
had
a power shortage that just zapped everything. The lights blinked and everything. So all's well now. I'm glad it was short-lived. Let me just pick up where we left off, talking about our discovering companies that were overmanaged and underled. And a lot of managers, when you ask them, why don't you extend trust? And they say it's risky, they're afraid they're going to lose control. A lot of them, though, really believe they think they're extending trust, but they're extending fake trust. You know, they're acting as if they trust their people, but then they micromanage them and hover over them, which is the counterfeit behavior to trust. And they're managing and administrating, thinking they're leading. So we suggest that extending trust is not too risky, the greater risk is not trusting enough. Giving people the benefit of the doubt, as we've been talking about, Brad and Tom, is the key to getting them to be trustworthy and to learn and to grow. And you actually ultimately, the quote you gave from Tony Hsieh, with a high trust culture, you actually get more control. Peter Drucker said, culture eats strategy for breakfast.
For breakfast, yeah.
You can have the best strategy in the world, but if you've got a low trust culture, you're not going to be able to execute your strategy. You need that high trust culture and an engaged group of people to be able to execute even the smartest strategy. So that's why we changed it, because we really felt, just like you had mentioned, that not a lot's been published on trust. As we've gone along these last few years focused on trust, we realized that even with all of the noise that we've been making, people were still kind of missing that boat, that distinction between management. And management's important, by the way. That's the important thing. I mean, a venture capitalist is going to make sure you have a good management team. But a lot of times in companies and startups, it's the passionate vision of the leader that's extending trust and bringing people around him or her that are more talented than they are that is the art of the deal. And so this whole idea of extending trust we felt was kind of lost, and that it is the number one thing, as we mentioned when we say that it's the fifth action, extending trust to others.
Right.
So that's why we changed it, and it's, you know, works out well. We've had a lot of good response to it, even though we didn't add anything to the book or take anything out. It just kind of shifted the focus for people to what we felt was the most important emphasis.
Yeah. Well, the subtitle of any book, I think, is really where the meat and potatoes is in any author's journey. For my own book, which is Liquid Leadership, From Woodstock to Wikipedia, it's my subtitle that gets people drawn in.
Yeah, no kidding. I'll tell you what, the minute Tom read it at the beginning, because I haven't read your book yet, but Woodstock to Wikipedia, you got my attention.
Well, it was like,
I'm a Woodstock generation.
Exactly. Well, I was sitting there when I was coming up with it. I have a marketing background. I was chief marketing officer for a publicly traded company. And I sat there and I said to myself, well, what really captures the essence of true baby boomers? Because I'm a cusp boomer, and I was raised on KC and the Sunshine Band, but my brother... My brother is 10 years older than me. He was raised in Vietnam. So that really didn't capture anything. But Woodstock, that word Woodstock really captures it. And this next generation, they're so connected. They're so instant. Everything's fast. It's either gaming, technology, or interactivity, or multitasking. And I said, Wikipedia says it best. And it's multi-generational management ideas that change the way we run things. And that
That's the ultimate extension of trust. I mean, you know, in the old generation, the academics just turn over in their grave about trusting the common person to have an encyclopedia written by a bunch of amateurs, you know.
Yeah, it is scary.
I was just talking to my wife the other day that when we were young, the only way to get an encyclopedia was at the grocery store or door-to-door salesman, and you had one at a time.
And
sometimes
pounds.
By the time you got to the Z, by the time you got to X, Y, Z, everything that from ABC has already changed. And so
It's true. By the time you bought them, they were out of date already. I remember having to do a book report on Nixon. President Nixon, and Watergate wasn't in there, even though we were living through it. I lived through it, so I had to go, oh, geez, Dad, we're missing a whole bunch here.
Funny thing,
Greg, you had
world, and I think it's positive. I really do. I think this transparency, this instant accountability, I mean, you know, everything's based on word of mouth, and back with Seven Habits, we didn't have the Internet, we didn't have anything, but
right.
Grew by word of mouth, and now what the social media does for us is it expands word of mouth, which can be good if you're good, and it can hold you accountable if you're trying to cheat. You can't sweep things under the carpet like they used to be able to do in the 60s and 70s in business.
And you're absolutely right. There's a magazine out called Strategy and Business, and they basically talk about, you know, in these results-only work environments that are team-driven, the ones that are not contributors, in other words, the takers, get weeded out very quickly because the givers are there all the time helping. And all of a sudden you see the person who's not working but barking orders, and they cannot survive in these environments.
Yeah, and it's a really healthy situation, I think, not only in individual organizations but in the economy at large. I don't think that we're going to tolerate a lot of the things we've been beguiled by in the past.
Oh, I agree.
Greg, totally agree. You've had the opportunity to work with two Stephen Coveys. Even when I was writing the webpage to promote this interview, I thought, geez, I got to get Stephen M. R. Covey's name in there because it's so good for SEO value. What was it like to work with Dr. Stephen Covey? As maybe everybody should know or knows by now, he passed away recently, wasn't it, Greg? This year?
July of last year. Yeah.
July a year ago, and now his son. And his son looks like he's taken up the mantle from his dad. Was this the son that wrote Seven Habits of Effective Teenagers?
No, that's his brother Sean, who's one of the executives at Franklin Covey. I'll tell you, the Covey gene pool has been an honor to learn about and watch Dr. Covey. He had nine kids, and all these kids, as I was working with him in the early 80s, he called home every night. He called his mother when she was still alive. He walked his talk like nobody I've ever seen
wow.
in my life. And as a result, working with all four of his sons, and I know his daughters, but three of his sons still work at Covey, Franklin Covey. Anyway, it's not nepotism. You know, that's one of the ultimate breaches of trust. I mean, I think people are getting promoted just because their dad is the founder of the company. Well,
right.
I'll tell you, that was about as far from the truth. Poor Stephen M. R. Covey, who's his oldest son, when he joined the company, started out as a telephone solicitor and a salesman and then a sales manager and then, you know, on and on. I mean, he worked his way all the way up, as all of them did. And it has been really remarkable to see the consistency of these principles applied in a family setting that bore such irrefutable proof. Every one of the kids has been extraordinary in integrity and competence in their chosen fields, and those that have worked with us at the Covey Leadership Center have, like I say, earned their stripes, so to speak, but they're all, Stephen M. R. Covey is, the apple does not fall far from the tree. And they were raised in this environment and held accountable from a young age. And Dr. Covey used to say, in many respects, his kids were better than he was because he had to learn by trial and error, and he was able to teach them a little bit more explicitly. One of the times for a family night with a family, he took them to a high-rise building that was under construction. And up on the girders and the beams and the wind, and he was showing the kids the plans and, you know, the whole idea of habit two, begin with the end in mind. You have to first write the plans and then you build the building. So he was constantly teaching these principles, and that's what ultimately became the Seven Habits, were a lot of the principles he was trying to pass along to his kids and to his students at the university. But the one thing I walk away with is just the tremendous, because I was with Dr. Covey for those 25 years mm-hmm. all the time, I was privileged to meet heads of state with him and other authors and CEOs, et cetera. And I'll tell you what, those that really walk their talk are few and far between. A lot of them are good at writing a good memo or a good speech, but those that really live it are really on the short list, and Stephen was one of them.
Wow.
So it was an honor. It was an honor.
I would say
so. How did you get working for them when you were young? Like, or you,
well, you know,
that's
a great generational story for you, Brad. Basically, like I said early on in my career, I was kind of an unconventional entrepreneurial type, and Stephen Sr., when he was thinking of writing The Seven Habits, asked Tom Peters in Kenny Blanchard, the One-Minute Manager, who were
wow.
the best-selling business books in the early 80s, what they would do differently if they had a chance, and they both told him that don't count on your publisher for much. You've got to get your own inside person. And Ken Blanchard, I lived in San Diego at the time, so I had the honor of knowing Ken Blanchard and Dennis Waitley and Tony Robbins and a lot of the other people, Brian Tracy, that all lived in San Diego. So at any rate, I was fortunate enough that Ken passed my name along to Stephen, and it's funny because when he first interviewed me, I told him I didn't want to go to work for him because I was from Colorado. I'd done my quota of snow. I'd moved to San Diego deliberately, and anyway. So my wife called him up. She was at dinner with us, and she said, "You know, Stephen, I know Greg's not going to go to work for you, but I'd like to learn how to teach the Seven Habits to the community here in San Diego." So Stephen invited my stay-at-home wife to Sundance ski area, where he did his executive training for corporate America. And so she was in a class with 30 or 40 other executive trainers in corporate America, became Stephen's star pupil, if you will, and he
wow.
took her aside and said, "I predict your husband's going to go to work for me." So she came back to San Diego, and his next speech there, I waited till he was done with his speech. I went up backstage, and I said, where do you get off? What part of no do you not understand? And I'll tell you what, I got the best lecture in 5 minutes on carrying your own weather with you, and that you are your values, not your moods, and mission is more important than money. And I went to work for him within 30 days. We actually came up with what he called a third alternative, where I stayed in San Diego for the first couple of years and flew back and forth to Sundance to the executive training. So, but anyway, it was a great opportunity, and I have, owe it all to my wife for having the vision that I didn't seem to have at the moment. It's funny, too, because I had listened to the very first there was a three cassette tape version of The Seven Habits that was published in the mid-80s before he published the book. And I listened to that when we drove back and forth from San Diego to Phoenix to visit my parents. And I just loved it. I loved his material. At any rate, we're all at the beginning of our careers, not as savvy as we end up at the end. Well, hindsight 2020, right?
Greg, I think Tom and I can both agree. We both blame our wives for our success because my wife, I can't see any vision in front of me. The good Lord above knocks me on the head three times. And that's the three I notice. Let's put it that way.
Yeah,
there are probably
the first
nine.
Three, the first six you didn't even know happened.
Right. Wait a minute. You know, and my wife would sit me down and she goes, you know, you need to write a book. I'm like, no, we don't. It's one of those. Yeah, then I'm in the middle of writing it. And she goes, you know, you need one last chapter. I go, no, we don't. And then I write one last chapter. And then my publisher goes, you know that last chapter? That's the whole
book.
That
made the whole book.
Exactly. And I'm like, oh, you got to go back to your wife with your tail between your legs and say, honey, you were right.
Hey, I want to give credit where credit's due. Sandra Covey, Stephen Sr.'s wife, the mother of all these Covey people I'm talking about, she was a force to reckon with in her own right, and she was the behind the scenes that kept the glue while Stephen traveled around the world. She kept the glue together of the family, and so it was a team effort, and he relied on her. She was always telling him, say, Stephen, don't make it so complicated. Just tell him. Make it simple. Make it simple. Don't tell him all that stuff.
There you go.
Nice. Yeah. Now, Greg, everybody can, of course, buy the book on Amazon. Is there other places where they can get extra benefits for buying the book?
It's available at Indigo and Chapters and Kohl's up in Canada, and also BarnesandNoble.com and Amazon.com, of course, and most airport bookstores have it. So that's RestoreTrustKit.com. We'll give them links to a number of different support, free things they can do to learn more about it, and it'll connect them to speedoftrust.com where they can, if they happen to have a company, where they can learn more. But basically the books are everything we know we've put in the book. So we sometimes lose sight of how much value there is in rereading these books. It's the 25th anniversary of Seven Habits coming up, and Jim Collins wrote the foreword for the 25th anniversary edition. It's really, you got to read it. It's really remarkable. But at any rate, they can get in touch with us and get the books, and then there'll be the website where they can get more help if they're interested.
And I even noticed I was on speedoftrust.com. You have a workshop, one of your workshops coming up to Toronto. Woohoo! And I see they're all over the place.
Yeah, we operate in over 100 companies at Frank & Covey now. Most of the international ones are with affiliate partners. We have a direct operation in Canada and England and Australia and Japan and Brazil. Most of the others we deal with partners, but we have been for 20 years. And so our international capability rivals our domestic capability. So wherever you are in the world, you can get the same expertise.
Fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. This event is January 21st in Toronto, a preview of the Speed of Trust transformation process. So looking forward to that, and looking forward to letting everyone know about this amazing book on a topic that, for whatever you're in, marriage, a parent, a business, a manager, a leader, a salesperson, If you build that trust, everything else will fall into place, or a lot easier fall into place. Thanks so much for your time today, Greg. I appreciate it. An honor to interview anyone from the Franklin Covey organization. I remember for years carrying around my Franklin Covey planner. It was like my Bible. I didn't leave home without it. So many memories tied up into that Franklin planner. And so continue the great work. I believe that you're on a purpose and a mission that impacts the world, because if we can restore trust among countries, among people, among each other, the world only becomes a lot better from there.
Yeah, well said. Thank you, Tom. It's been a privilege to be with both you and Brad, and I wish you guys the best, and you guys have made a great difference. And Tom, you're the poster child for all this stuff, you know, with all the adversity you've overcome to stand tall, if you will, and keep the attitude and the vision that you have. It's inspiring.
It is.
Thanks so much, Greg, and thanks for joining me, Brad, today. I appreciate that.
An honor, as always. Thank you so much, Greg. Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate this. I learned a lot today. Fantastic.
Have an amazing day, guys. Thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.